Hello and welcome to Power of the Parent, the podcast. I'm your host, Charlotte Speak. I'm a level 7 CMI accredited coach, a StrengthsScope master practitioner, mental health first aider and talent consultant. And I'm also the face behind Power of the Parent. In this podcast, I'll be speaking to parents in the workplace. Some of them are in traditionally employed roles, others are running their own businesses, and we're having conversations about life in general, insights about being a parent and having a career, and exploring the strengths that parenting has awoken for people. We will talk about things like the value that they're bringing to the workplace, as well as my guests very generously sharing their personal stories and anecdotes about everything life can throw at us. Hello and welcome to the next episode of Power of the Parent, the podcast. Today, I am absolutely thrilled to be joined by the one and only Vikas Shah. You may or may not have heard of him. If you haven't, then you've probably been under some sort of rock. But Vikas is the CEO of the Swisscott Group, which is one of the UK's largest suppliers of textiles from stock in the UK. He's also an entrepreneur, would describe himself as an entrepreneur, an investor, a philanthropist. He is also the non-exec board member of the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy. He's also a non-exec chair of the Audit and Risk Assurance Committee, which all sounded like incredibly technical and complex. And you'll also find him hanging out on the non-exec board of members of the Solicitors Regulation Authority and Shoesmiths LLP. Don't even get me started on some of the charity work and pro bono stuff as well that he does. It's like an incredible list. He was awarded an MBE in 2018 and in 2021 became the Deputy Lieutenant of the Greater Manchester Lieutenancy. He's also an Honorary Professor of Business at the Alliance Business School, which is at the University of Manchester. And as if he had time, he's also written a book called Thought Economics, which includes insights from conversations with the likes of Matthew McConaughey, Tim Peake, Shaquille O'Neal, Jessica Ennis-Hill. And also, after a really quick little Insta search, I reckon quite a keen photographer too. But I'm going out on a limb that I haven't checked that with him before I've made this introduction. And that isn't everything. They're the things that I saw and was like, wow, that's just... Wow. So thank you so much for joining me today. And
thank you for having me.
Has that captured at least the top 10 things that you might?
Yeah, I mean, it's always scary when I hear my bio back, because it's one of those where I just kind of keep going and keep doing the things that are interesting or add value. Yeah. And then, you know, it's a bit like running a marathon for 20 years, because then when you look back, you're like, oh, wow, okay, there's quite a few things there. But you know, it was never the aim, let's say, but you know, it's been an interesting journey.
It definitely sounds like one heck of a journey. And today we're going to do a little bit of a conversation about flexible working at Swisscott in particular. But as you will be aware, if you are tuning in as a regular listener, we are here to talk about supporting parents in the workplace and probably, you know, just hold up some examples and just explore a little bit about what your experiences and your stories been. So I know that you have been a really big supporter and a big part of the conversation about what flexible working means for you within your company. It would be great just to hear a little bit about what that journey is looking like so far and how it all came about.
Yeah, I think all businesses are kind of adapting, right? Because you know, we'd always tried to make sure that we enable as much kind of remote access and things as possible, because inevitably people had, you know, days they couldn't come in. So this was pre-pandemic. And then in the pandemic, I was really pleased we had the infrastructure in place, because it meant that when we had to all mobilize from home instantly, you know, we had the systems to do it. So I was really pleased the team had been very proactive with that. I think the big challenge, and I think it was for all businesses really, is how do you manage at a distance? You know, because businesses, you know, you have to maintain productivity, you have to maintain all those things that are important to keep the cash coming in. And that was a challenge. And I think the only way we found to do that well was by having good conversations with people. So having line managers have conversations with the team, me having conversation with the team, just being really open and honest and saying, look, you know, I'm worried. Like, how do I know that you're still going to be doing your job well at home? So rather than me accusing someone, it was more, how am I supposed to know? What do we do mutually that makes it work? Mm-hmm. And I think the mutual respect part is something which I've sadly seen missing in a lot of businesses. So there's a lot of businesses where they've imposed, you know, lots of systems and monitoring and so on, but without ever having that consultation with the team, say, well, what do you think would work? How do we do this properly? Because I think the vast majority of people who work flexibly, you know, still want to do a really, really good job and work really hard. And in many cases, they work harder, you know, and do more. But there's always going to be a cohort that don't. And we've got to protect the business, you know, as you would do in an office environment, from people that underperforming, but also make sure that that doesn't come at the cost of introducing in, you know, massive processes and blockers for people who are.
I think something that you just touched on there, that that you said there about that cohort that don't, like, there will always be those people. I think one of the things that I find with clients that they struggle with is to make that differentiation between that isn't flexible working not working. Yeah. That's somebody not working. That's correct. A performance issue.
Yeah.
And trying to get them into that headspace of it's okay to manage those people, because what you're not managing is poor flexible working. You're managing potentially poor performance.
Yeah. And people who are underperforming will always find a way to hide, right? And whether it's in the office where they might, you know, sit there looking busy and they're always busy and they're always, you know, too busy to have a chat, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
You know, whether they're working in the office or at home, they'll find a way. And that's just kind of symptomatic sometimes of underperformers. And so, yeah, that's not a fault of flexible working. It's just the fact that there is always going to be that cohort of people who you have to manage. Mm-hmm. And it's just the methods of managing them are different in both environments.
Yeah, completely. And it takes me back to one of the very first line manager workshops I ever did. And I was talking to this line manager, and this was pre-pandemic, and he had a real bee in his bonnet about working from home and said, well, you know, people just want to do it because they want to sit watching Homes Under the Hammer. And I don't even know if that's still on. This was a conversation back in like 2019. And, you know, kind of let him have his say and hear his concerns and things like that. And there was a whole discussion about that. And then a little while later, we were doing another exercise, and I went round and was listening in on some of the conversations. And he said to me this time, when I go to site and I'm going in to check in on the teams, it's always the same people in the break rooms. They're not at the desk. And I was like, right, I'm just going to reflect something back to you right now. So earlier, you don't want people working from home because they might be watching the telly. And now you're saying when they're in the office, they're not working. So, like, what's your beef kind of thing? Like, there doesn't seem to be an ideal situation for you here. What are you holding back on? What are you not facing into? And we ended up having a discussion offline, not in the session, about his whole experience as a line manager, some of the things that made him feel like very drastically uncomfortable, which included performance management. So he was okay kind of going, this is a load of rubbish, I can't get this format to work. He was fundamentally, in his own words, he had been overpromoted and hadn't had the right support to be a great line manager. Some of the, you know, the kind of the more practical side of things and how to initiate some of these conversations. And He went on actually to get some investment in his development to help him be a better line manager. But sometimes that's not an uncommon viewpoint to have even now for people, is it? It's like,
no, not at all.
Like, what is it that you're reaching for?
Yeah, but this is also linked to one of the truisms in progressing your career, which is the higher up you get in any organization, the more of your job will entail things that you don't want to do. And you don't like to do, and are not nice, fun things to do, right? And I've seen too many people in too many businesses who want that title of manager or director or head of or whatever, but what they don't want to do is put in the work to learn, you know, how do you performance manage someone? How do you have really hard conversations? How do you let someone go? How do you do that? Mm. And how do you put up the necessary, you know, emotional walls that you sometimes need? And so I think what we sometimes see is exactly the manifestation of that, where you just have line managers who don't know how to manage their teams well and who don't want to have hard conversations. And those hard conversations are necessary. It's like in anything in life, sometimes it takes somebody to say something's wrong for a discussion to then happen.
It just harks back for me to that major opportunity cost. If you don't have those conversations, what is the impact here?
It is, because, you know, as much as a business is a community, right? And, you know, it's a group of people who are doing something amazing and building something. But ultimately, you know, what's the scorecard? The scorecard is your accounts at the end of the year. Mm. And if you want those accounts to be healthy, what that means is everyone in the business has to be productive, has to be performing, has to be doing well. And so that does entail a lot of hard conversations. Mm-hmm. And one of the issues is, you know, when managers kind of sometimes want to be everyone's mate, it's difficult.
Yeah.
Because I think it's really important that everyone has cordial, friendly relationships, but you can't cross over the line where you become so friendly with someone that you can't have a tough conversation.
Oh, yeah.
And in the remote world, that's become even more exacerbated, because I think a lot of managers feel scared of having conversations, because they feel like, if I have a conversation, does that mean I'm being a dinosaur? Does that mean I'm breaking some new work from home rule? When you're not, it's just a standard kind of conversation you have to have in business.
Mm. And I think something that you touched on there, one of the things that can make a lot of these conversations really work well are boundaries. So understanding that, and boundaries aren't all about saying no, are they? And they don't have to be like ridiculously rigid and restrictive, but if they're not there, that's what then causes some of these issues that you don't feel in a comfortable position to be a line manager. If your default position is to be more like, you want to create a welcoming culture. You want people to be able to bring their whole selves to work, but ultimately you're going to be measured as a line manager. And part of that is being able to manage your team, isn't it?
Yeah. And look, everyone needs to feel, you know, you spend more time, I know it's a cliche, but you spend more time at work than you do with your family and friends, right?
Yeah.
So you have to enjoy it, and it has to be a good place to be, and it has to be fun and all those things, right? But, you know, to use a kind of, let's say, non-work analogy, you know, if you're bringing up kids, let's say, or you have a partner, there's a responsibility you have to them to tell the truth. And there's a responsibility you have to, you know, keep each other in check. And that's about mutual respect and mutually moving towards a specific goal. Mm. But it's also, I think, it does require open conversations and hard conversations. And that doesn't always mean they're bad, by the way.
Yeah.
It just means having a conversation that says, okay, this has happened or that has happened. What do we do together to make it work? Can we make it work?
You've just prompted a thought in me there about, sometimes we're probably going off on a slight tangent here, but something that you made me think about was how we sometimes brand some of these conversations. So we will call them difficult conversations, you know, preparing for difficult conversations, or having, I remember a workshop that I used to deliver in corporate world was about preparing for courageous conversations. And, you know, there's an element of drama there, isn't there? And actually, one person's difficult conversation might be another person's dead easy one. And that it holds a lot of nuance, doesn't it, conversation? And I think sometimes we build that up, and that means that we avoid having some of these discussions, or we don't kind of speak our whole truth, or we try and again do that kind of people pleasing, super delighter. Oh, I really actually need to have a conversation because they're not quite delivering, but yeah. I don't want that to be, you know, I don't want that to destroy a work relationship. And it means that we then hold back. And actually, exactly what you've just said there, you have a responsibility to the people surrounding you, because you're doing them a disservice if you don't face into this, some of this stuff with them.
So there's two things here. So first of all, you know, you're doing anyone a disservice if you don't tell them the truth, because, you know, that's really important. But the second part of it is the opposite way around. It's really important for, you know, colleagues in a business to tell the management and tell the owners when something's going wrong. And it's incumbent on them to listen. You know, I am so, for example, I'm so proud of that there's a whole movement called Pregnant and Screwed. Yeah, and it's outing some of the awful practices you see in businesses where, you know, you are seeing people who are, you know, engineered out of businesses as a result of, you know, becoming a parent. And, you know, that's not hard conversation territory. That's ethics and morals territory, right? Mm-hmm. And this is the nuance. The nuance is, having a hard conversation is just telling someone the truth, or having a conversation about something which is, you know, legitimate. But what we can't do is create a working culture which becomes so hard and so tough, let's say, mm-hmm. that we start to cross those ethics principles. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had friends of mine who work in kind of big city firms where, you know, after a bereavement, their line manager's like, okay, so you'll be in a couple of days, I guess. And you're like, that's not humane. It's not a humane way of running a business.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of the stories that I am extremely familiar with Pregnant Then Screwed for a variety of different reasons, because I've had to use their services myself, but I also now do a lot of partnering with them to support employers. And I know Jolie and the team over there. In fact, we're recording this.
Amazing.
We were recording this at the beginning of November. So I've just got back from London, having taken my two little girls to the London March of the Mummies.
Amazing.
And it really was. It was incredible. And I think something that strikes me quite a lot about the discussions that we have with the Pregnant Then Screwed manifesto is there is clearly a lot of change that we need to make from a legislative point of view. There's a lot that the government needs to answer for. That's definitely one side of it. I think sometimes then it can feel very overwhelming as an employer of, well, where the heck do I start then? Because I'm operating on the background of, we've got a broken childcare system. We've still got a long way to go around flexible working legislation. It's creeping forward. It's doing really well, and it's definitely gaining some momentum. But sometimes it can feel quite confined about the art of the possible within your own kind of employment Correct. World. So I think one of the messages that I'm really keen to kind of share out there with people, when I say people, I mean employers and line managers, is to really look at how you can empower yourself and think about what is the art of the possible. What can you influence? What could you put in place locally?
Yeah.
That, okay, it might not be government advised, or it might not be something that has been spoken about at a national level, but what works for you as an organization? And I kind of get the vibe that's a bit of your approach as well, that you've found ways to look at what you can influence and what you can do. Mm-hmm. And that's what nobody's going to have your back like you are.
Yeah, I mean, there's two points to that, right? So if we come to the government point first, like any organization, you can only change what you know is wrong, right? Mm. And when you're dealing with anything political, shouting from the outside never gets anything done.
Mm.
You only make change if you come to the table and have a conversation. And you know, if the civil service are doing the heavy lifting, writing legislation, trying to get things done. And it's really rare, really, really rare that people will go and just talk to them and say, look, I'd love to just come and share some ideas. I'd love to come and just share some thoughts on how things could change for the better. Because there's an extent to which, A, that's harder. B, it doesn't feel as good as just shouting. But it is really important, because legislation doesn't change if people don't participate, right?
Mm.
In the same way as, we look at, for example, the referendum, the outcome is as good as the participation in the vote. And that's important. The second thing is, we can't build a culture where we do rely on the government for everything.
Mm.
The reason we have a charitable sector, the reason that we have a social enterprise sector at all, is because there always are things that governments can't do, can't be seen to do, don't want to do, or which are too risky to do, right? Mm. And that's actually in every single part of the world, where the social enterprise and charitable sector pick up, and so does corporate engagement in society. Mm. And so we've got to be realistic and think about, okay, well, what bits realistically can the government fix? And so, to give you one example, if we think about the gig economy now, the gig economy is creating a whole new class of worker, where you might work, 2 hours for one company, 1 hour for another company, 3 hours for someone else. But in aggregate, you are still working full time. And then the question is, okay, well, who is then responsible for your workers' rights? Which of those employers? And there's no answer to that right now, because it's all brand new. But that's somewhere where the government can have a meaningful perspective. But the fact that independent childcare is very expensive in a very expensive city like Manchester or London, there's not a great deal the government can do about that, but there's a lot the community can do about that.
I think there is a government element, and we won't get into some of the nuts and bolts of it on this episode, but there is a huge amount that is underfunded.
I think that goes without saying. I think underfunding of health and social care across the board is a real issue. And I think, childcare comes very much into that, because, it's not just giving parents a place where children can go when they have to go to work, and they're all sets. It is part of their well-being and development and all these things. So yeah, there's definitely things there which are underfunded, but at the same time, it's amazing how much more happens with civic participation. Because MPs naturally will only deal with the issues that they think voters are concerned about. So I would always encourage people, whatever party you support, write to your MPs, get engaged in civic issues. You know, all these things make a difference at putting the pressure in the right place for things to change.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I totally agree with that. I think one of the things that strikes me when we talk and I look down your experience and your growing plethora of roles that you're involved in is that kind of that you've got two worlds meeting of you and your business world. And then you've got these kind of non-exec roles that you're participative in. And you can already hear that the one informs the other, I'm sure. But how do you kind of manage that blend as a as an individual? And I suppose your version of flexible working, I guess.
Yeah. So the only reason I can do that is because the business is at a stage where I've got an exec board in place. Mm-hmm. So if I didn't have an exec board in place running the business, that I couldn't do it. Simple. And and that's very much the reality of it, right? Because for me, the reason I take on non-exec roles is because they are an incredible way of keeping the tools sharp, because I'm going into all these other organizations, seeing, you know, best practice, seeing what they do really well, seeing mistakes that they're making, learning, you know, collaborating with brilliant people in different organizations that I wouldn't normally maybe get to. And so it's like having a constant learning process outside the business. And that, and it's also just very kind of, you know, intellectually satisfying as well. But, you know, I've had this conversation as well with, for example, friends who are freelancing or in SMEs who are looking at the non-exec world and the trustee world. And I say, okay, well, you know, I would always encourage everyone to do it, but you've got to just make sure that, you know, your income is protected and that you're doing it for the right reasons. There's a bit of a rule I found, for example, when we've recruited non-execs into businesses and things like that, a good non-exec has the power to walk away, right? Mm-hmm. Meaning, if you're a non-exec of an organization and you don't agree with their practices, you should be at a financial position where you don't need the income, you can walk away. And I worry sometimes that people look at portfolio careers as non-execs as a substitute for an income, and it removes one of your most important governance tools, which is the power to walk away if something's going wrong. So you do need to balance it. And you do, again, you do need to be realistic and pragmatic about it. So like I said, for me, unless I had an executive board running the business so I could be, you know, on rather than in the business, there's no way I could do those things outside the organization. But that also means being disciplined with time, being, you know, and having the right support. So, you know, my EA supports me with calendar and diary and has a lot of authority to respond to things on my behalf. And so you've got to delegate enough of your life to make it work.
I think that's a really strong message to send, because in my line of work, I will, although I'm generally working with organizations, I will have people contact me, especially on social media, and be like, I need to work for myself. Childcare costs through the roof, or my career feels like it's ended now. I've become a parent in the workplace. I've, you know, feel like I've been written off. Mm-hmm. The way to go is definitely to work for myself. And I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I just need you to take a step back for a second, because actually there are some home truths about working for yourself that lots of people don't say out loud. I'm more than happy to share the warts and all side of it, and often do, because I think sometimes, so different world, but I would mirror across a lot of the messaging you've just shared there about that kind of non-exec world, that there are so many misconceptions about how it happens, what the financial situation is for it, that the fact that, yeah, you might be working flexibly in a different way to what you could in an organization, but the work still has to be done if you still need to make money. And I think most of us need to still make money. And there can often be this narrative about shortcuts. How do I do it in 5 easy steps? That kind of approach. And I find myself more and more often saying to people, not everything has a shortcut to it.
And one thing which I'd love to just mention is there's so many predatory advisors out there, right? So
that's a really good go on, That's a really
if I go on Instagram, so sometimes if I go on kind of my business Insta, if you like, all I'm seeing on there is I'm being pushed all these people who are kind of in inverted commas coaches, and they all use the same thing about how they can give you the shortcuts to 10x your income if only you spend £1,000 with them on their course, right? And there's so many people selling snake oil to freelancers, and there's so many people selling absolute tosh to freelancers around coaching and development and all this. Sad part is it means that it's much harder for you to pick out the real coaches from the 9 out of the 10 who aren't. But it's also targeting a vulnerable group, because when you start out on your own, it's really hard and you're really exposed. And so you are vulnerable and you will look for help and assistance. And there's all these people who are kind of, in my view, being very predatory, burning the resources of individuals and giving them no real value. And if anything, making their lives harder by selling them non-truths. Like you said, you know, there's no shortcuts. It's really hard. You know, building business is really hard, whether you're a freelancer or a large company. And no amount of, you know, going on coaching seminars will help you with that. You have to just do it and get on with it, right? And so I would really urge people to think about who are they turning to for advice, and what's the motivation of the person giving you the advice? What's their skin in the game? Because the minute you ask yourself that question, sometimes it reveals, you know, quite surprising truths about those individuals.
I wholeheartedly agree with so much of what you said there, and find myself having very similar conversations. I would also, if we can go down a corporate route for a second, is I would extrapolate that advice that you've just given there, those questions to ask yourself, who is giving you the advice and what is their role? What is their stake in what they're suggesting for you? I would say that to businesses as well right now, because the world is very busy and very noisy with experts telling organizations how they should be looking after people's well-being, or people like me telling you how to look after parents in the workplace, or how you should be engaging, and all of those things, almost like there's this magic checklist that you should be going down. And it just doesn't work like that. We have to stop perpetuating this one size fits all. Of course, there's commonalities, like absolutely, but every organization has got a unique culture. And I think exactly what you said there, if you're an employer listening to this, I would absolutely put the lens that you've just shared over any advice that you're getting before you set out on any strategy, any view of, and I'm saying this in my world for parent support stuff, I would absolutely ask those same questions, because not everybody's got the scruples that you wish they had.
But it's also, there's legitimate areas in a business where actually external consulting and perspectives are really important. So, you know, if I take the example of what you provide to businesses, a lot of businesses get that wrong because they don't know what right looks like, and they don't know what they ought to be doing. Mm-hmm. And so there's a legitimate case for you to come in and help a business and better understand, how do we create a better working culture for parents that doesn't compromise on performance, but gives people what they need. So there's a legitimate need for that. Mm. You know, we receive so many of these through the door, you know, people saying, oh, I'm going to come in and for only £5,000 do a wellbeing seminar for your team. And I'm like, yeah, but really? You know, that's the difference, is businesses have legitimate gaps where external expertise is needed. Mm. And that external expertise can be transformational. Right. And, you know, to an extent, that's the function of non-execs, to the extent that's the function of external consultants and advisors. But it's really up to the business owner to be able to identify that properly and realize that what you're doing is you're not, a lot of business owners can get lazy, and any problem that occurs, the default is, let's just find someone who can come and sort it for us. So they'll find someone to come and do a well-being seminar, but their working environment is still horrid. Right. Mm. The amount of investment banks that have probably had mental health seminars, yet the environment hasn't changed. So that's the difference, because the business has to do a lot of hard work too, and know the experts to bring in.
Yeah, hugely. You've got to work together for it to be transformational, haven't you? Yeah, I completely agree. I could literally talk to you all day and could probably go off on about 57 different tangents, but I won't. Maybe we need to do like a part 2, 3, 4, and 5.
Very happy to.
But I'm going to leave the conversation here because I think that's a great end and a really important and timely reminder, because I know that there are lots of people listening to this who are employers that are going through that tussle of, Who do I listen to? When do I bring somebody in? What's right and what's wrong? And I think the value that you shared around that importance of mutual conversations, that there is a difference between flexible working, not working, and performance management issues. And that reminder that legislation doesn't change if people don't talk was a really big takeaway for me. And I found that incredibly powerful. So thank you so much for your time and generosity of thought. I know that loads of people will now be looking you up and getting that book.
And one thing I'd love to just mention, if I can, is for people who are in businesses, know your worth, right? And what I mean by that is, you know, we all have an inbuilt sense of right and wrong. And, you know, you need to have those conversations with your line managers and say, look, this is my life and here's what I need to do to do my job well. Will you support me? And there's plenty of occasions where the answer to that question might be that you change your career and move on because that business is just not leading with heart, right? Mm. Because the number one job of a business owner is to lead humanely. And that means that you respect, you know, the circumstances of individuals in your business.
Yeah.
But one thing I can tell you is that there's been lots of occasions over the years where people just haven't had the conversation and things get really bad and really stressful. And, you know, it always comes back to, well, if I didn't know, what am I supposed to do? You know, so you have the conversation, please. It's really important.
Now that is the perfect end to the episode. I think that's such a powerful message that will resonate with everybody, like whether you're talking work life, home life. Maybe we should add like relationship counselor to your list of endeavors, because I have a feeling some of this advice could go a long way in relationships.
Yeah. Well, always happy to come on whenever you need. It might be fun to do a clinic together where maybe people, you know, write in their questions and we can answer them together or something. But, you know, congratulations on the amazing work you're doing covering really important topics on your podcast. And, you know, it's a pleasure to come on and have a chat.
Oh, thank you so much. That means a huge amount. And I am well up for that idea. We are definitely going to talk after this and see what we can arrange. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for sharing your story and your incredibly valuable insights. Thanks very much for tuning in to Power of the Parent, the podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, please rate, review, and subscribe. And if you could tell all your friends about the podcast, that would be wonderful. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find me on Instagram. Just search Power of the Parent. See you next time.